We will have our reading now, which is 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1 to 24. 1 Samuel 9, 1 to 24. Samuel anoints Saul. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zerah, the son of Bethkorah, the son of Ephiah of Benjamin. Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. Now the donkeys belonging to Saul's father Kish were lost, and Kish said to his son Saul, "Take one of the servants with you and go and look for the donkeys." So he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and through the area around Shalisha, but they did not find them. They went on into the district of Shalem, but the donkeys were not there. Then he passed through the territory of Benjamin, but they did not find them. When they reached the district of Zuph, Saul said to the servant who was with him, "Come, let's go back, or my father will stop thinking about the donkeys and start worrying about us." But the servant replied, "Look at this town. There is a man of God. He is highly respected, and everything he says comes true. Let's go there now. Perhaps he will tell us what way to take." Saul said to his servant, "If we go, what can we give the man? The food in our sacks is gone. We have no gift to take to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered him again. "Look," he said, "I have a quarter of a shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God so that he will tell us the way to take. Formerly in Israel, if someone went to inquire of God, they would say, 'Come, let's go to the seer,' because the prophet of today used to be called a seer." "Good," Saul said to his servant. "Come, let's go." So they set out for the town where the man of God was. As they were going up the hill to the town, they met some young women coming out to draw water, and they asked them, "Is the seer here?" "He is," they answered. "He's ahead of you. Hurry now. He has just come out. He's just come to our town today for the people of a sacrifice at the high place. As soon as you enter the town, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. The people will not begin eating until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterwards, those who are invited will eat. Go up now. You should find him about this time." They went up to the town, and as they were entering it, there was Samuel coming towards them on his way up to the high place. Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him ruler over my people Israel. He will deliver them from the hands of the Philistine. I have looked on my people, for their cry has reached me." When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." Saul approached Samuel in the gateway and asked, "Would you please tell me where the seer's house is?" "I am the seer," Saul replied. "Go up ahead of me to the high place, for today you are to eat with me. And in the morning I will send you on your way and will tell you all that is in your heart. As for the donkeys you lost 3 days ago, don't worry about them. They have been found. And to whom is all the desire of Israel turning, if not to you and your whole family line?" Saul answered, "But I am not a Benjamite. But am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me?" Then Samuel brought Saul and his servant into the hall and seated them at the head of those who were invited, about 30 in number. Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the piece of meat I gave you, the one I told you to lay aside." So the cook took up the thigh with what was on it and set it in front of Saul. Samuel said, "Here is what has been kept for you. Eat, because it was set aside for you for this occasion from the time I said, 'I have invited guests.'" And Saul dined with Samuel that day. May the Lord bless the word to us as we study it later.
What makes a good king? It may just be me, But I do feel like there's been a lot of the royal family in the news recently. At first, it was the Jubilee. We had those pictures in the news of what's the name of the youngest son who was pulling the faces as the aeroplanes went over? I can't remember. Archie, there you go. That was Louis. Yeah, Archie's the other. Yeah. Wrong fat. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know much about it. Well, you've got Prince William. He was handing out prizes at the European Championships. We've had smiling photos of George and Charlotte returning to school. And I even saw a commemorative magazine for Princess Diana at Aldi, I think it was, just recently. What is it that we're looking for in a monarch? Can anybody here answer the question, why is William more popular than Charles? That's a tough one. What makes a good king? As we read through the next bits of 1 Samuel, that's a very good question for us to be asking. What is it that makes a good king? Here's where we've got to. Steve took us through chapter 8 last week, but before that we've had, if you like, the life and times of Samuel. Samuel, the last of the judges that God had raised up in order to protect his people, to lead his people. And last week we saw chapter 8, Samuel grew old and he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders. And his sons did not follow his ways. So the people come and ask for a king. Samuel's sons have not been a good replacement. And so they come and ask for a king. Now, as we saw a bit last week, asking for a king isn't necessarily a bad thing. Back in Deuteronomy 17, Moses records this. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let us set a king over us like all the other nations, be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. So, at the very least, it's neutral, this idea of having a king. But what's the problem? We see this in verse 6 and 7 of chapter 8 last week. The Lord told Samuel, listen to all the people are saying to you, it is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. Requesting a king isn't necessarily bad, but God knows the heart. He knows the reason behind the request, and he knows that what they are actually doing is they are rejecting him as king. They just want a king like the other nations. Someone they can see, who can lead them in battle, an impressive warrior figure. Not a God who's actually invisible. Someone who they can kind of point to and say, look, he's in charge. This is what our nation is like, perhaps. So God says, give them what they want. Here's the thing, having a king is good. But depending on whom that king is. So it's not just that God's saying, yeah, they're asking for something bad, and I'm going to give it to them to show them how bad it was that they've asked for. No, it could be that God is actually looking to bless his people by the provision of a king. But again, the question comes back, what makes a good king? The people are just thinking of someone impressive to show them up as better than the surrounding nations. What do we look for in our leaders? Are you for Dishy Rishi or in Liz We Trust? In Liz We Trust. That didn't quite come out as I was supposed to. Never mind. Policy, charisma, diplomacy. Within the church, what are we looking for? Someone who stands up and confirms what I already think. Someone with an impressive pedigree. Someone who draws a crowd. Someone who teaches the Bible. Someone who's a good listener. What are we looking for in our leaders? Chapter 9, we start the search for a king. And as this story progresses, well, there's real ambiguity. Is this person, who we're going to come on to, going to be good? Or is he going to be bad? as we go through, we might see which direction we're leaning in. So let's start. Chapter 9, verse 1. There was a Benjaminite. Immediately, we're thinking, oh, a Benjaminite. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because here's the thing. Back at the end of Genesis, Jacob, the father of the sons who became the tribes of Israel that we have represented here, gave some blessings to each of his children in which he said things about their future. And it was to Judah that he said that the scepter of kingship would come. To Benjamin, he said he was going to be like a ravenous wolf. Now, you don't need to have a big knowledge of wolves, or indeed the way the Bible talks about wolves, to think that's probably not a good sign. And then in the book of Judges, just before this, in the narrative of God's people, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, have committed some horrible sins and have basically been judged for it by all of the others who fought them, killed most of them. This is a tribe that has messed up, been punished for it, been decimated, and is only just recovering. So a Benjaminite, not sure what I think about that. But it was a man of standing. His name was Kish, son of Abiel. And again, this probably doesn't, not immediately occurring, but apparently Abiel, God is my father. That's what the name means. Pretty good heritage so far. A man whose father's name is God is my father. I'm going to follow God. So maybe it's better than that. A good family tree. But actually, it's not Kish, son of Abiel, that we're then pointed to. We're pointed to his son, Saul. And Saul's name is interesting again. Saul literally means he asked, or he begged, or the one begged for. So the people have just been asking for a king, and along comes Saul, whose name means the one asked for. And we're thinking, oh, but is that a good thing or not? Like, they were asking for a king for the wrong reason, so what's Saul going to be like? He's handsome. That's the first thing we're told. He's handsome. As handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in all of Israel. And he was a head taller than anyone else. Great. He'll look brilliant on a postage stamp. But of course, is that a good thing? Interestingly, in the Bible, Joseph is described as handsome in the context of something to do with his moral uprightness. So maybe it's hinting at something good. He's a head taller than anyone else. If we're looking for a military person, then that's probably a good thing. And we could go on. We're deliberately getting this sense of ambiguity. In fact, it's like the narrator is forcing us to ask the question, what makes a good king? Is this man going to be it? Now, verse 3, the donkeys belonging to Saul's father Kish were lost. And Kish said to his son Saul, take one of the servants with you and go and look for the donkeys. So he passed through. Just wait a second. Here we've got a son listening to his father and doing what his father's asked of him. We've got a bit of a contrast here with Samuel and his sons. Actually, here is someone who's listening to his father. And that is a very good thing. He's obeying his father. He goes off to search for the donkeys. He passed through the hill country of Ephraim and through the area around Shalisha, but they did not find them. They went on into the distance of Shalim, but the donkeys weren't there. Then he passed through the territory of Benjamin, but they did not find them. I'm kind of imagining this in a kind of speeded up comedy way of them kind of walking through and it's all speeded up and they're looking everywhere and they can't see it. Kind of black and white movie with those frames that come in between saying, no donkeys, with, you know, the ornate lettering around the outside, something like that. It seems a bit comical, it seems a bit farcical, but again, what is going on here? Why, in God's great wisdom, did he inspire a passage about searching for lost livestock? Well, when I was living in Japan a number of years ago, I was working on a website, bilingual website, Japanese and English. I wasn't doing the Japanese part, but I had to do all the back end, and I was really, really struggling with it. I had a problem that I just couldn't fix, and I had a week of just battling this one problem with the website. It just wouldn't do what I wanted it to. And towards the end of the week, I suddenly thought, have I prayed about this? And the answer was, no, of course not. God doesn't know anything about, you know, HTML and PHP and MySQL and bilingual. He doesn't know anything. Of course he does. Actually, God knows more about the intricate day-to-day realities of life, including, in my case, crazy bilingual websites, and in Saul's case, lost livestock. He knows more about it than any of us. He is intricately involved in the everyday of everyone's life. And so, again, I'm wondering, is the fact that they haven't asked for the Lord's blessing or asked for the Lord's help a sign of something to do with Saul that we should be worrying about, or is it just that they don't mention it? Again, and you can see where I'm going with this, there's ambiguity. Verse 5, Saul gives up. Verse 6, the servant has an idea. Is that a sign of good leadership, surrounding yourself with people who are more intelligent than you, or is it a sign of abdicating leadership? Again, we don't know. But finally, we start to get somewhere in our story. Let's go to the man of God. Perhaps he'll tell us where to go. Saul throws up problems. What can we give this man? We don't have anything. The servant says, oh, you know, I've got just about the right amount of silver to give him. We can take that. And so Saul says, yeah, all right, that sounds like a good idea. So they set out for the town where the man of God was. And now, verse 11 and onwards, things start to progress to a climax. And I'm doing this going upwards deliberately because as we read through it, you'll see again and again the word up. Up, up, up. We're going up the hill to the town where they meet some young women and they ask them about the seer. He is, they answered, he's ahead of you. Hurry now. He's just come for a sacrifice at the high place. As soon as you enter the town, you'll find him before he goes up to the high place. The people will not begin eating until he comes because he must place the sacrifice. Go up now. You should find him. They went up to the town, and as they were entering it, there was Samuel coming towards them on his way up. You wouldn't write it that many times unless you're pointing at something. We're building to a climax here, and here it is, verse 15. Here's what's been going on. Now, the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him ruler over my people Israel. He will deliver them from the hand of the Philistines. I have looked on my people, for their cry has reached me. We get an insight that Saul doesn't have in all of his searching for these donkeys, that God has been at work behind the scenes in the intricate day-to-day reality of a farmer looking for a foal. God's been involved. Not only that, God has been deliberately sending Saul to this destination, giving his servant the idea, giving his servant just enough money, leading them there. So they bump into the women at the well, who then point them further on, and then they just happen to bump into Samuel. And of course, Samuel knows exactly why they're there. When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man I spoke to you about." it's Saul. Saul is going to be the king. But there's still ambiguity as to whether that's a good thing. He will govern my people, the text reads. It's an unusual word. Don't get the word that often. Could mean govern. But it could mean govern rather like a prison governor who restrains, who hems in the people he is governing, keeps them under control. Is it a good kind of governing? We're not sure. We're not sure what Saul's going to do. But the next thing we see is very positive. Saul approached Samuel and said, "Would you tell me where the seer's house is?" "I am the seer," Samuel replied. "Go up ahead of me to the high place, for today you are to eat with me. And in the morning I will send you on your way and will tell you all that is in your heart. As for the donkeys you lost 3 days ago, don't worry about them. They've been found. And to whom is all the desire of Israel turned, if not to you and your whole family line?" I don't know if you've seen the Disney film Beauty and the Beast, whether the original animated one or the more recent one with Emma Watson. But there's this character in it, Gaston. He's the handsome guy of the village, the kind of eligible bachelor, except he's a real... It's not very nice. But he's handsome and he knows it. And he kind of thinks that Belle, the heroine, should realize it too. And so he is constantly trying to get into her affections and to impress her in some way. There's an entire song just saying, "No one fights like Gaston." I'm not going to sing it, so I can't remember the lyrics. "No one does anything like Gaston. He is brilliant and he knows it." And you can imagine that Saul could be a bit like this, from a family of standing, clearly well off. They've got servants, they've got donkeys. He knows, I assume, that he's pretty tall and handsome. And Samuel has just told him, "To whom is all the desire of Israel turned, if not to you and your whole family line?" And if you're Gaston listening to this, you're thinking, "Yeah, I know it." What does Saul do? "Am I not a Benjaminite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me?" Isn't that the kind of quality that you want in a king? Humility. "Why do you say that to me? I'm not that impressive. Have you got the right guy? Actually, someone who is not pushing himself forward." And the result of his humility is he is given a great honor. Verse 22. "Samuel brought Saul and his servant into the hall and seated them at the head of those who were invited," the place we assume that would have been Samuel's. "And Samuel said to the cook, 'Bring the piece of meat I gave you, the one I told you to lay aside.' So the cook took up the thigh with what was on it and set it in front of Saul. Samuel said, 'Here is what has been kept for you. Eat, because it was set aside for you for this occasion from the time I said, I have invited guests.'" Now, again, it's not obvious to us, and this is only from some of the reading that I've done that I realize this, but the thigh portion was the one that priests would take home to give to their family. So by setting Saul at the head of the table in Samuel's place, and by giving him the portion that was for the priest's family, what we've got here is a sort of adoption. Not literal, precise adoption, but it's pointing in this direction. Here is Samuel publicly, if you like, handing on the baton of leadership to Saul by saying, "Actually, you are, if you like, my son. I know that my biological sons, they have not gone my way, but here I am, if you like, appointing a new son. One who will lead God's people and hopefully follow after me. We get in next week's passage, we kind of get a hint of that's what's going on, because when Saul returns to his family, we suddenly hear mention of his uncle. And it's like, where's the uncle come from? Well, it's almost as if his real father, Kish, is now just an uncle because Samuel is his new dad. There's that sense of great honour being given to Saul because of his humility. But of course, there's the ambiguity. Will he turn out better than Samuel's biological sons? What kind of king is he going to be? Now, of course, if you've grown up with these stories from the Bible, you'll know that Saul does not turn out to be a good king. But for the next couple of weeks, we'll see that he starts well. And in this passage, we see that there is real potential. There are some things where we're kind of not quite sure, but actually there is a lot of real positive here, particularly his humility. It forces us again to ask that question, what is it that we are looking for in a king, in a leader? Are we looking for his good looks, his military prowess? He's got both of those. He's got humility too. And I think it forces us, or it forced the first readers to be thinking about this. They'll be going back to Deuteronomy 17. And they'll be looking and seeing, what is it that God was... What had God called the king to be? So let me just read again from Deuteronomy 17. When you enter the land and you say, let us set a king over us, be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. He must be among your fellow Israelites. Tick. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver or gold. At this stage, we're wondering, like, actually the humility that Saul has shown here, maybe that'll be a tick too. Don't know yet. But when he takes the scroll of his kingdom, the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the Levitical priests. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites, and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. This comes up again and again in the Bible, what the king should be like. The first psalm that we would have done many years ago in the summer, the psalm of the king. Blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do prospers. So this is what we're looking for from Saul as we continue in 1 Samuel. Is that humility going to continue? Is he going to delight in the law of the Lord, listening to him? Is he going to remain humble, or is he going to surround himself with many wives and many warriors? Which way is he going to go? What about us? Who are we going to look for in our leaders, whether that's political or within the church? Are we going to look for the same things, those whose humility is what distinguishes them, who don't think that they are better than anyone else, who don't lord it over, who don't surround themselves with people for their own glory, but rather point to the Lord. And of course, the biggest thing that we get as we look at Saul and we look at fallen human kings is the contrast. The contrast with the Lord Jesus. Saul, from the least of the tribes. Jesus, from the tribe of Judah, but from the least of places, growing up in Galilee. Jesus, a son obedient to his father, like Saul was in this passage. One who goes out to find those that have been lost, but he succeeds. One who serves the people he is king to, who puts them before his own needs. I read this morning, if you were here, from Philippians 2. I'll just carry on with that reading from this morning. Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And like Saul in this passage, that humility is then followed by honor. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Jesus is the King that we need. If we've been part of churches for a while, we know that. But he's also a wonderful picture of the kind of human leaders that we need. Just like Saul, those whose humility is what marks them out. And it is when they humble themselves that God honors them. True for all of us. One of the letters Peter wrote says, you know, humble yourself under God's mighty hand and he will lift you up in good time. That is the pattern. The pattern of Christian leadership, the pattern of Christian living. Humbling ourselves so that God would lift us up. And so the best human rulers and leaders will be little pictures of Jesus as they do that. I was struck recently reading, I haven't brought it with me, I had it a few weeks ago, a new book called The Air We Breathe by Glenn Scrivener. And in it, he makes the point that the reason we have government ministers today, the word minister is servant. And the prime minister was the chief servant. Now, we don't necessarily see that in our politics, but our whole, the way that we named our politicians was based on this idea of humble service being the way of the world. Because that is the way of Jesus.